Welcome to Beyond the Crucible. I'm Warwick Fairfax, the founder of Beyond the Crucible.
I think there's so much hope for this profile. One of the reasons that that is true is because this person has a strong vision, or the seeds of a strong vision. And I think that that is rare, right? So many of us just move ahead and don't understand what purpose they care about most, what legacy they want to leave behind, what forward looks like. And I think that's a really exciting place to be. You don't have to figure out the vision, or you might have to figure out some manifestation of it, but you've got the fire, right? And that's an exciting place to be. You've got the fire, you've got the clarity, you've got a picture in your mind of what the next stage of life could look like. And that's a really hopeful place to be.
A really hopeful place to be. Maybe you'll be surprised to learn that the profile from our Trials to Triumphs self-assessment we're referring to here is the one we call Afraid to Trip. What's hopeful about that? Hi, I'm Gary Schneeberger, co-host of the show. You'll learn the answer to that question in this week's episode as we discuss how those who receive this result are closer to living their life of significance than they likely realize. They've processed their crucible, they have a vision they'd like to pursue, but they're wrestling with emotions that are keeping them from moving forward. But if they tap into the safety, encouragement, and support that can come from others and from shifting their self-talk and the worries and fears that guide it, the obstacles they've worried about stumbling over can change from virtual boulders that seem insurmountable into pebbles they can't even see.
Let's talk about Afraid to Trip. What does Afraid to Trip mean?
So, Afraid to Trip is someone who has taken, it's one of our six You Are Here starting points on the Trials to Triumphs roadmap. And somebody who is got the profile of Afraid to Trip, they have understand that they've had a crucible, and they have largely processed that crucible. They're no longer angry about what went wrong in their life, whether it's a failure, a loss, or a trauma. And they're not really, they don't really feel like it's holding them back. However, they also even have a high vision for what where they would like their lives to go. So they have a sense of purpose and a sense of direction and so on and so forth. However, the disconnect is they have a low reality score. They're actually not doing the things to turn that vision into a new reality.
It seems like this Afraid to Trip person is, they have a vision, but they're cautious. They're held back by something. And maybe, maybe they've gotten over the crucible in one sense, but as we're finding with some of these profiles, sometimes there can be the odd string attached. Like you think, I'm good. And you might be good in so many ways, but it could be the fear of, a different life. You can be comfortable with your life, even if your life is like, my life's okay, but it could be better. And gosh, I have this great vision, but I'm afraid of leaving my comfort zone for the uncertain future. Or you can be afraid to succeed even, but it just seems like this is a challenging place to be because you have a vision, but there's this sense of caution and fear of like, but I don't know. I mean, it's a good vision, but just do I really want to change? And do I have enough of what it takes? And you get through this almost cycle of angst of, it's a tough place to be.
We all understand what it's like if we've been through something before, to have a fear of getting hurt again or a fear of failing again. It's really easy to have that inner voice really talking to you saying, well, but remember what happened last time or whatever, or gosh, I don't want to go through that again. So you might think of this as even if they've got that vision, they have to find the passion to sort of really want to pursue it. The passion has to become greater than the pain, I think, right? And We all, as we've talked about before on this series, we all as humans gravitate toward what is familiar, even if it's not quite comfortable. And what's familiar can be very comfortable. And there are good reasons when you've been through a trauma or a failure or a loss, there are good reasons to not always want to move out of the comfortable into the unknown, right? Because there's risk in putting yourself out there. And does the risk match the reward, right? That's a calculus that we go through when we're taking our first steps outside of our comfort zone, especially when we've gone through something that might have slapped us back in the past, right?
You know, I think of the image of that fairground game we've always all done, that whack-a-mole, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think of like a little animal and its burrow. And it's like, last time I stuck my head out, I got whacked, you know? So there might be this wonderful future out there, but it's kind of irrelevant how wonderful it is because I'll get whacked again. So I'm just going to stay in my little burrow. You know, it's a little dank in here, a little gloomy, but it's safe. And out there is scary. And so, yeah, you're right. When you feel like whether it's the fear of failure, fear of success is greater than the desire to change, you're going to stay in your little burrow because you don't want to get whacked. So let's talk a bit about a bit more about this person. So what might this person who got this afraid to trip profile, what might they be feeling? What might they be going through?
Well, I think they might be feeling cautious. They might be feeling fear. I think worry is something that really can play a role, especially when you're not sure whether you should take a new risk or not. They might be replaying their crucible. They might be revisiting something they thought that they let go of and replay, what missteps did I take or how did I deal with that? How would I deal with it again in the future? They may be pain avoiding or they may be experiencing some self-doubt, right? Doubt about whether I can be successful the second time around or whatever that looks like. There's something that if they're not moving forward toward pretty clearly or articulated, at least seeds of a vision, that there's something stronger than the desire to move forward that is holding them back, right? And even though it doesn't feel like your crucible, it may still be attached to it, right? If we're thinking through every time we say, I don't want to fail again, or I don't want to be hurt again, those are still the remnants of our crucible speaking to us, right? Our crucible experience.
I'm intrigued by this profile because the vision score is high. And, you know, Warwick, you talk about people's vision. The vision that you want to pursue is a vision that you're off the charts passionate about. So there are people in this place of being afraid to trip who are off the charts passionate about a vision, but maybe at the same time, they're off the charts. Am I up to this vision? They're off the charts. Do I have the skills for this vision? They feel like their charting might be a little lower in terms of being able to pull that off. And that seems to present a different kind of reluctance or fear or not moving forward in that you know kind of what you want to do in some cases, in all cases, but in some cases, you don't think that you're equipped to do it. And I would think that is particularly difficult to stomach. And maybe one of the reasons why, right, that you don't share it with other people because other people will go, oh, come on, that's not going to work. That's not going to happen. I went through that just like you were talking about, Cheryl. I went through that myself when I started my business. Are you sure you can do that? You know, sure, is that going to work? So it's intriguing that vision isn't the panacea to everything. Sometimes vision comes, you can have it, but you still have trouble pursuing it.
I'm reminded when Margie Worrell was on the podcast, the wonderful speaker and author on bravery, especially speaking to women. You know, she's such an incredible, dynamic, accomplished person. And I remember when she talked about writing her first book, and she talked about saying, who am I to write a book, right? I'm just a farm girl from the, you know, backwoods of Australia. And who am I to write a book? the vision was clear. She had a book, she had a topic, she knew what she wanted to write about, but that inner voice was mm-hmm. holding her back and saying, and then she over time developed this vision of, who am I not to write a book, right? Well, of course I can do that, but there was a journey there from who am I to write a book to who am I not to write a book, mm-hmm. right? Of course, why wouldn't I write a book? And I think that's a great characteristic of not only are you vulnerable to criticism from others, or you're worried about that, but even what we say to ourselves.
So let's talk about, assessment takers might be wondering, we've talked a bit about this, but they might be feeling kind of downcast and this might not feel great about getting this result. So it's easy to feel like a bit of doom and gloom as you get this result, but maybe there are other perspectives in the doom and gloom one when you get the results of this. So what do you think, Cheryl?
Well, Warwick, what I think is, and this is a key role that the assessment plays, is knowledge is power. Knowing where you are at gets you 80% of the way there, I think, right? Somebody I knew once said, right, making a decision to do something is 80% of the effort. And I think even just taking the assessment and getting this result is illuminating. It gives you the opportunity to self-reflect on what's really holding you back. It allows you to have the opportunity to reflect and say, okay, I've got a vision, or I've got the seeds of a vision, something. Why am I not moving, right? Is it myself holding me back? Is it fear? Is it worry? Is it practical matters? I'm worried about paying the rent. What are the things that are holding me back? What can I then do about it? Because we all know that if we've got the ability to process through that, we can find a way forward. But when you're just sort of living in it, you're not really able to do anything about it. So this gives you the opportunity to self-evaluate and say, you know what, I'm ready to start. I'd like the vision to be stronger than the reason to stay safe, or to say, you know what, I'm still not ready to move forward, but maybe I'll dip my toe forward, or to say, you know what, I'm ready to go. I'm really ready to start rolling ahead and starting to do something about it. It really gives you the information you need to figure out where you're at, what's holding you back, and let go of that when you're ready so you can actually start moving down your path to triumph.
Let's talk a bit about, obviously we've talked about, it may feel like a pretty challenging place to be, but I think as we're hinting at, there is hope. So what kind of hope should this person feel who's in this place?
I think there's so much hope for this profile. And I think one of the reasons that is true is because this person, right, has a strong vision, or the seeds of a strong vision. And I think that is rare, right? So many of us just move ahead and don't understand what purpose, right, they care about most, what legacy they want to leave behind, what forward looks like. And I think that's a really exciting place to be. You don't have to figure out the vision, or you might have to figure out some manifestation of it, but you've got the fire, right? And that's an exciting place to be. You've got the fire, you've got the clarity, you've got a picture in your mind of what the next stage of life could look like. And that's a really hopeful place to be. Likelihood is it's going to continue to weigh on your soul if you don't do something about it over time, right? At some point, if these are scales, at some point that weight's going to get heavier, right? Most likely, right? And if that weight starts to get heavier, the weight of the pain of not acting, one of two things is going to happen. As that weight starts to get heavier, you're actually going to be triggered to action, or over time you might develop regret of what was not pursued and not done. I think those are the two shapes that can take. There's always a cost to doing nothing, right? We don't live in stasis. We're either growing or we're shrinking in some ways. So at what point does that discomfort get greater and trigger you to action? And what can you do to start moving forward? I think one of the nice things, the other benefit of this profile is it's about taking a first step. It's not about selling everything you own and moving to a mountain. It's not about, right? You don't have to, you know, it's not about quitting your job and becoming an artist tomorrow. There are all ways to take small steps. And I think the biggest answer for this person, this afraid to trip person, is looking for the safety, encouragement, and support to bring alongside you to help you take those first steps forward. Because one of the things we know is when we start moving, that's what gets the flywheel going. But we need to feel safe. We need to feel supported. We need to feel encouraged. So how do I find, maybe it's a professional who either a life coach or a business coach or a career coach, or it could be a therapist or a mentor or even a fellow traveler. Maybe it's looking for like-minded people. It could be somebody like you. It could be a complimenter. These are things that we can start doing to that are lower risk. It doesn't require a reinvention of life. And that's when the flywheel gets moving, right?
I like what you said, Cheryl, about how one of the things that can make you most hopeful in this profile is you have a vision, right? I mean, let's go back to when it's even sort of behind the scenes stuff, when we were developing the model for processing through your crucible. It was refined design, vision, reality, right? You were refined by your crucible. You dug into how you were designed. You learned lessons from it. You crafted a vision off of that, and then you pursued reality. And that's the third step. Vision is like you're almost there. And when you were talking, Cheryl, I thought about this, and I just unplugged the power to my computer, which I'll put back in after I say my point. But this is your vision, right? I mean, your vision's here. All you have to do is plug it in. There are a lot of people who are wandering around and they don't have that. You have this, folks. If you have a strong vision, if you have this profile, your journey is simply finding how to plug it in, where to plug it in. And to Cheryl's point, you don't have to just immediately go running down the street and jam it in. I mean, you can figure out the best way to get to a place that you can plug it into, but you have this, and this vision is a critical step that puts you closer to your reality than you probably feel like right now, than you probably understand right now.
Such a good point, Gary. Yeah, it's that strength of the vision that can pull you forward. I mean, another way of putting it as positive and negative is that it's easy to think, what's the cost of doing nothing? Well, the cost of doing nothing will tend to grow bigger and bigger and bigger. We often talk about legacy here, as do a number of others. You don't want to be on your deathbed. You don't want to be thinking about what they'll say at your funeral. And, you know, nobody will say this, but you don't want people thinking while they're at your funeral. You know, he or she had this vision, but I don't really want to say it out loud, but they're a bit too afraid to make it happen. And you're thinking to yourself, if they said that, they'd be right. I was too cautious. I left a vision undone. It could have helped people. It could have made a difference. We'll never know. That haunting sense of what if, there's a massive cost to that. You don't want to be that person, as has been said, better to have tried and failed than never to have tried at all. So it's a myth that just it's going to be more comfortable just staying in that little burrow and doing nothing. It will get increasingly more uncomfortable. And so at a certain point, you know, when we'll talk about, you know, my journey here in a bit, but at a certain point you have to say to yourself, you know, this vision is good, but it's not just about me. Think of the difference I can make in other people's lives. Let's assume that you're on brand with us at Beyond the Crucible, where we believe a vision should lead to a life of significance, a life on purpose dedicated to serving others. It can mean different things to different people. Let's assume you're on brand, so to speak, with us here at Beyond the Crucible. In that sense, if that's your definition of a vision, you know, don't you want people to be helped? Don't you want the world to be a better place in some small way or big way? So there's both the positive and the negative. And what Cheryl, you said is right, is you've got to deal with the inner voices, and certainly surrounding yourself with people who will encourage you. Mm-hmm. You can have well-meaning family members that just say, you know what, people like us have to stay in this role in life. Well, they may be lovely human beings, but that's not going to be helpful. Mm-hmm. You need to surround yourself with people that see, you know what, I can see this. I can see this happening. Yes, with the right tools and the right people, I can see it and encourage you. Surround yourself with people who are encouragers, as well as people who have complementary gifts. You know, whether it's people that you hire or friends you get advice from or people that help you out a bit on the weekends, there are different paradigms, but there are ways to make this vision less scary. It's not just about you. You can have a team of people who encourage and different gifts, but you've got to decide to make the shift. Don't deprive the world of your vision. And the myth that this won't cost anything, the cost will increase every year.
And what does it mean to have a strong reality score, right? A high sense of reality. It's, I'm taking risks for the things that I'm passionate about. I'm making sacrifices to get where I need to go. And nothing is going to stand in the way of me getting where I need to go, right? That's when you start moving toward that vision and you realize that you're not willing to let boulders get in your way, right? You're not willing to let roadblocks get in the way. You're actually going to work around them. And suddenly, I actually think what happens is you start moving toward a vision and you start letting go of that pain of the past or that worry or that fear, that whatever that residual is. It's not that you can climb over these big boulders, but they sort of melt away, right? It doesn't mean you're going to have a smooth path, but suddenly things that felt like big boulders when you were in a different mindset, right, all of a sudden don't seem like that big of a boulder anymore.
It's so well said, Cheryl. I mean, having encouragers and people with complementary gifts is so important. But, you know, one of the keys in addition to that is being willing to take one small step. And we've talked about mm-hmm. this. You've talked about this, Cheryl. And it can feel like a microscopic baby step, you know, but mm-hmm. just one small step, because often you feel like if I do this, people will laugh at me. If I do this, it'll fail. If I talk to this, if I try to arrange a lunch with somebody to say, I've got this vision, I'd love to get your input, they might laugh at me. Well, maybe they didn't laugh at you. Maybe they said, you know what, that's actually a pretty good idea. I mean, it'll be hard work, but just having that lunch with somebody and them not laughing at you and saying, I think I could see this is possible. And I think with the right help, I think maybe I could see you doing it. That might feel like a little baby step. What have you risked? It costs nothing. Well, not much anyway, depending on where you go. But it doesn't cost that much to have lunch with somebody. You know, it's a low risk probe. That can be huge. Okay, that's one baby step. Okay, maybe the next baby step is talk to some people that might be, you know, maybe you can do it together with. And maybe they'll say, boy, I'm so glad you said this because I could totally see you doing that. So one baby mm-hmm. step leads to another. But very often, and we've heard this from so many guests on this podcast, they will tell you that first step was the hardest. Yeah. Almost to a man or woman, they'll say that first step was the hardest. So if you're in this position of afraid to trip, take that first step. It will be a game changer, I think.
Well, let's put what you just said to the test, Warwick. if indeed the first step is the hardest, I've been sitting here for the last 7 minutes going, oh, I want to ask Warwick a question about this. So share with our listeners and viewers, Warwick, was there an afraid to trip moment in your journey back from your crucible? And was that first step, you can ask, you know, answer this at any point in answering this question. Was that first step really hard for you?
Yeah, it's a good question, Gary. I mean, there were probably afraid to trip years from about 2008 to getting my book, Crucible Leadership, Embrace Your Trials to Lead a Life of Significance, getting that published in the fall of 2021. But it's funny, one first step in one sense, which is, you know, still, it was a game changer in some ways, but yet there were still challenges to come. It was in 2008, the pastor of my church asked me to share a sermon illustration in our church. He was giving a series of messages on the life of David. He was being persecuted by King Saul, who basically wanted to kill him because David was doing too good a job. Fortunately, these days, your boss may not like you. It's typically not quite that drastic. Anyway, so he was in a cave feeling pretty sorry for himself and righteous man falsely persecuted. So I said, look, I brought a lot of mistakes on myself. I'm no King David character, but fine. You want a 10-minute sermon illustration? If he thinks what I had to say can help, then obviously that's up to him. But was there fear in doing that? Yes, because I'd never really spoken about my story and lessons learned. And certainly didn't think of myself back then as a great public speaker. But somehow people came up to me after that and said, boy, your story really helped me. And I'm thinking, how many ex-media moguls are there in the congregation? I mean, none. I feel like my story is a story that nobody can relate to. It has zero universal appeal because it's just not a universal crucible, losing a 150-year-old, $2.25 billion family media business. So anyway, but that gave me the vision, but yet, you know, it wasn't like all, roses and sunshine afterwards. So I had this idea, and the idea for the book was basically lessons learned, talking about mistakes I'd made. There will be a strand talking about my family, the Fairfax family, some inspirational and faith leaders, historical leaders. I had sort of an idea of how it would look, but it took me, you know, years and years to write it, even though I had a relatively clear vision of what the book would be like. It took about 5 years till I even had a first draft. You might ask, well, okay, are you that bad at writing? I actually like to think I'm reasonably good at writing. It's not, you know, those cars that, I mean, especially for men that say, sorry, honey, I don't know how to put my thoughts into words. I never get those cards because there are things I'm bad at, but I've never had any trouble expressing my feelings in words, you know, in written or otherwise. So that's not the issue. It was really more fear and pain that was making me, I don't know if I was moving forward. If I was, it felt like looking at a glacier. Glaciers move, but doesn't look like they're moving. And part of the reason was, imagine writing a book about your worst nightmare, your worst mistakes, the most painful things. I'd write for 2 or 3 hours a day when I was writing, and I couldn't do anymore. I was done. I was emotionally wrought. I was just, I was spent. So it was really hard, very painful. There was fear of, what will people think? And will people think, oh, yeah, Warwick's writing a book, especially in Australia. Who cares what he has to say? He destroyed a 150-year-old company. People tend to think of the media as biased. Well, when you personally have caused, massive pain in their career and personal lives, they have every reason to feel aggrieved towards me. So, yeah, I would be thinking they're not going to cheer me who made their life so difficult. You know, it's very personal to them, and I get it. So eventually 2013 comes along, and I went to Australia, spoke to some potential publishing companies and literary agents, and some said, well, it's been a lot of years ago. Maybe the time has passed, but if we're going to write something or publish something, it's got to be a tell-all book. I was never going to write a book dissing on my family and throwing dirt and mud. It's just not part of my value set, and I'd rather not have it published. So that wasn't particularly hopeful, but I thought, well, let's just keep moving ahead. And one person gave me some contacts, a freelance structural and copy editor. That, believe it or not, took another year or two to refine the manuscript and it was a lot. And then one publisher helpfully said, for it to get published in the leadership space, which is what I was thinking at the time, you've got to have a brand. You've got to have a high social media following. You've got to speak so that there's sort of a bunch of raving fans already willing to take up your book. I said, brand. I went to Harvard Business School. I get the concept. Branding makes sense. So chatted with a few people. And then I came across a friend of mine who knew Cheryl and, Signal Brand Innovation. And even then, it wasn't like it took, a bit of time to build the brand, so build the social media things that happen overnight to get the book published. So it was a long process as I think about it, you know, in the afraid to trip sense, you had the external and the internal fear, the feeling like, oh, you know, people are going to be a bunch of naysayers. I caused hurt amongst the family. What would they say? What would the media say? There was a feeling of like, you know, if you asked me, what do I know about leadership back then? I would have said, and did say, I couldn't lead my way out of a paper bag. I would have said, I'm a terrible public speaker. I would say, you know, what do I have to offer? You know, when I do things, it hurts people. So maybe I just stick in my hole and don't do stuff. So there was a lot of negative internal self-talk and definitely some realistic external fears of what, especially the media in Australia. So yeah, it was, while that talk in church in 2008 was a step, it felt like there was years where there may have been progress, but it felt glacial-like. And part of the reason for the glacial-like progress was it was so painful and there was so much fear and self-doubt that was absolutely holding me back.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me, work that we hadn't talked about earlier, but I think also as you were talking about your own fear, but also very realistic fears of what would the Australia, you know, you're sort of waking the beast, right? The Australian media, right, industry, you know, self-protection is a legitimate feeling, right? This desire to protect yourself from what has gone before is a legitimate way to feel. I think that just really struck me. We hadn't talked about, you know, what does that feel like or look like to really feel the need to protect yourself because you've been under attack or vulnerable to hurt or vulnerable to trauma or loss, right? That's a very real factor as you're trying to move forward, but you did.
Yeah, indeed. And folks, if you're listening right now, and that describes you in some way, which Cheryl just said, here's the good pivot we're about to take, because Warrick is about to talk about how did you move beyond, right? There's a lot of stuff that you just explained that left you afraid to trip, but you're not afraid to trip right now, so you've moved beyond it. How did you do that?
You know, it's an interesting question, Gary. I mean, I am an innately cautious person. Some people say, hey, let's go bungee jumping, let's go skydiving. I'm not that person. I tend to think very carefully before I do things. So when you have caution with some understandable fear of, as you know, Cheryl, you said, sort of stirring the beast, if you will, that was tough. But I think really what kept me going was, I guess, the strength of my passion for the vision outweighed my fear and caution. Mm-hmm. And I'm somebody, you know, faith in God, faith in Christ is a huge part of me. Values are a huge part of me. And I also have high perseverance. So if I feel like something needs to be done and I am the one to do it, it's my calling in some sense. You know, Bible talks about the still small voice of God, that inner sense, from my perspective, that call from God that you need to do this. I find it very difficult to say no to that because then I'm saying no to everything I believe in. So if I felt like if my story can help one person, it's worth the pain of writing this book. And it was painful, but that kept me going. That kept me motivated through writing the book, through the editing, structural copywriting, through the conversations with publishers in Australia who, you know, I was looking at some stuff the other day, even the ones that said no, they felt like there was something there. These are experienced publishing executives. It's like, you know, it's honest, it's vulnerable, there's hope. They were, even though it was no for their publishing house, they felt there was something there. That was very helpful. I mean, it really was. But just that sense that my passion for the vision, and it wasn't about me, it was about helping others. It's like, if this can help one other person, it's worth the pain. It was that simple. If I can help one other person, it's worth the pain. And so it kept me going. And
the other thing I'm struck by as you say that is once you first, you know, I've always been struck by the story of your first talk in church and you saw evidence you never thought that you would ever see. Why would this be resonant to anyone else? And yet, you saw this evidence that people really resonated with and related to your story. And as that flywheel of moving toward your vision, even if it was at a slow pace, moved forward, you started to identify more evidence that you were moving in the right direction and looking for evidence that you were going bit by bit, that you were going in the right direction. I'm really struck by the value of that insight, Warwick.
And Warwick's not the only one who's gone through this journey. It is funny. It is interesting. Not funny. It's interesting that so far, all of the profiles that we have discussed in detail, Warwick has had some time in each of them. That's interesting because it sheds some insight into Warwick's story. But it's also interesting, folks, keep in mind, if it's happening to Warwick, if it's happened to Warwick, it'll happen to you. This is not, we've made the point throughout this series mm-hmm. that your results will be your you are here moment right now. That doesn't mean that you yeah. were here 2 years ago and that you're going to be here next week. It's mm-hmm. a journey. And these are waypoints along the journey. So what we're hearing from Warwick is here's where he was in his journey. And he was indeed, at some point, he was afraid to trip. And he just told you about how he got over being afraid to trip and the benefits that have come from that. And as we do in every one of these episodes, we went back and we looked at some of our podcast guests to find those that fit this profile of afraid to trip. Again, when we talked to them, they weren't afraid to trip, pretty much. When we talked to them, they had hit their stride. But they, as they told their crucible stories, as they told coming back from that setback and failure, they passed through, they spent time in afraid to trip. And the first one that we're going to talk about is, I think, the 322nd Australian guest that we had on the podcast, Stacey Kopass. And Stacey, very interesting. She was in a diving accident when she was 12 years old in the suburbs of Sydney. And it left her a quadriplegic, and her spirit was in tatters. She, in her teen years, substance abuse, behavioral problems. She even had suicidal ideation in this process of just, you know, her life. She'd been an athlete in school, and her life was in many ways, she thought the life that she knew for sure was over. Very depressing situation that she was in. But a huge turning point in her life came when this realization came to her. She said this: "We connect with other people through our adversity, not our success." We've heard that from in different words, but the same spirit, the same import of what's being said by many guests have said that. And she also came to see her crucible, Stacey Kopass did, and her paralysis, not just her crucible, but being a quadriplegic, she saw that as a blessing. Brilliant. She didn't immediately know how to channel all of this that she was learning, but she worked to become a public resilience speaker and found her life of significance. Warwick, I know Stacey's story really moved you when we talked to her. Go through some of the afraid to trip moments that she went through from her crucible.
She really had this mindset shift. She decided that she was going to use what she'd went through to help others, and she was going to speak on resilience. And even that was tough because she said, well, who am I? Almost echo Margie Worrell. Who am I? I don't right. have a PhD in psychology. And she felt mm-hmm. underqualified. She felt less than. But she was able to push through that. And when she said, and there might have been somebody else before that, but this was one of the early ones that really resonated. When she said what she went through was a blessing, it's like, that seems almost reprehensible or incomprehensible, I should say. It's just, mm-hmm. how can being a quadriplegic be a blessing? It makes no sense. But her truth, her perspective is that she felt like she didn't really take life too seriously. Maybe she felt like she was hanging out with the wrong people. Her perspective, and how can we possibly know? But her perspective is that her life wasn't necessarily going to go in a good direction. Right. And now that she had this mission to help others, a message of resilience, she had purpose in life. So from her perspective, her truth is that it wouldn't have happened without this tragic accident. That is her perspective. And that's what I think fuels her to try to help others. But seeing what she went through as a blessing, and you know, when we spoke to her, she just oozed happiness. She has a right. permanent smile yes. on her face. It's like,
yes, indeed.
It's just, how is this possible? She's just this fun-loving, happy person. Life is clearly not easy, but she's yep. just this a happy person. She's the kind of person you want to be around. He doesn't want to be around happy people, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't want to have somebody lap that over for dinner or hang out with friends. Of course she is. So I think her real way of getting beyond her afraid to trip moment is she had this vision for her life that would help people. It gave her life purpose. And initially it was like, well, I have this vision, but you know, who's going to take me seriously? But yeah, you know, she took baby steps and she made it happen.
And who is Stacy Kopass? I mean, her self-talk, who am I to be right. a resilient speaker? Here's who you are, Stacy. And I know Stacy listens to the show because I get notes from her from time to time. Who you are, Stacy, is someone I have quoted at least 4 dozen times on something you said to us when we talked to you. And that was this. Crucibles are like being on a trampoline, right? The farther down you go, the more traumatic your crucible is, the higher up you can launch. I've never taken credit for it. So if you are listening, Stacy, I always give you credit. But that is a remarkable perspective to have from going through a crucible.
The other thing I remember she said is, we can change the story that we choose to tell. Mm-hmm. Rather than, I had this terrible accident, I came up quadriplegic, life is awful, I just made a stupid mistake, I should never have done it. That's one story, which he chooses to share a different story, a story of resilience, a story of comeback. So her attitude was, you know, basically choose that story and get on with it.
Yeah. You know?
And that's absolutely what she's done.
Right. Yeah. And she is not, if there's anybody that we've talked to who's not afraid to trip at this moment, it's Stacy Kopass, because she's moving. She is moving. Another guest who talked about an afraid to trip moments that she went through is Carrie Schwier. Just some big high level beats of her story. At age 7, she says she remembers thinking this, is this all there is to life? At age 7, that's early to be thinking, is this all there is to life? Before she embarked on a journey of some soul crushing crucibles, even as she found success in her multiple career stops, she was successful, right? But she wasn't living significantly, and she still had some deep doubts inside. Things still crushed her. She had a vision for success, but not significance, and the success eventually left her. Warwick, I know you'll talk a little bit more about some of these things, but she lost jobs, she had strained relationships, there was a lot of that stuff that going on. But when she became concerned about what she called her gray area drinking, her research into the subject and passion for helping others overcome it launched her on a new act in her life that she is pursuing with absolute gusto. And that is as a life coach who helps her clients overcome gray areas, not just in terms of alcohol consumption, but in every aspect of their lives. Warwick, I'd love to hear your perspective on her stories and Cheryl from you as well.
Yeah, I mean, Carrie Schwier is an amazing person. Her life has not been easy. Often with people that are successful, we don't really know the backstory. She moved around a lot with her parents, almost seemed like every year or so, her parents got divorced. It's hard to have friends when you keep moving. And that was a challenge for her. There's stories about being on the block in a neighborhood and who do I have to play with? And it felt like there was no one. She was abused physically and sexually by some older boys at school. That obviously, that leaves a mark. She just had this almost chronic lack of self-confidence. You go through a variety of these traumas, moving, abuse, divorce with her parents, that's going to leave a mark. And mm-hmm. It's interesting, she's been married to her husband for many decades, and she had such poor self-esteem, she said, why would a nice guy like that want me? Mm. Now, sometimes life doesn't work out and you get matched up with somebody that's not helpful. She had the opposite experience. She, out from the get-go, got this wonderful guy. But it was like, well, you know, he doesn't, like, I don't deserve him. I'm not worthy of him. You don't often hear that kind of story in that case. But that, so she just felt like unworthy in general, unworthy. You know, what does he see in me? I'm, you know, broken. I'm not worthy. Yes, she was successful in what she did, but basically these inner demons from abuse and just constant moving and divorce from her parents, it had consequences. And so she would do what's called gray area drinking. She never thought of herself as an alcoholic, but, you know, drinking on Friday and Saturday nights, it would go to, from into Thursday and Monday, and the weekend would become longer. Mm. And she never really thought she had a problem per se. But her husband said, well, why do you do this? Because unfortunately for him, her husband's mother was an alcoholic. So alcoholism was a searing thing in her husband's experience. So that was sensitive to him, seeing his wife drinking too much from his perspective. And so why was she drinking? She hated her job, but beyond her job, she just felt chronically insecure. She just felt unworthy, unworthy to be married to a husband, unworthy in general. And I think her truth, her perspective is that's what was fueling her the gray area drinking, not feeling worthy enough. So, I mean, it's sort of a remarkable story, but what I love about her story is how she got beyond that, the sort of gray area living, not feeling worthy, gray area drinking. It was gray area in every way. She decided to bring this idea up to her church, and they had some other, you know, recovery program. And it was like, well, sorry, we already have something and we can't use what you've done. And, you know, which I'm sure she felt miffed about, understandably. And, you know, she, I think, talked about it with some friends, and she didn't give up. But it was not easy, I'm sure. Just, you have, you know, negative self-talk.
Right.
It can't have been easy to make that dream a reality, but she did, and now she's in such a better place. I have to believe that her negative self-talk is less. I would hope that she's in a position where she can say, maybe, you know, maybe she would say, actually, my husband's lucky to have me. Mm-hmm. I would hope she's in that place where she can honestly say that. I would guess that she is. Which would be a turnabout, and I'm sure her husband would agree that he is lucky to have her as his wife. So it's a great turnaround, but it wasn't easy.
Our third guest, folks, who went through this, and this was he was one of my favorite guests. This gentleman, his name is Dennis Gillen, and Dennis lost his two brothers, both committed suicide, 11 years apart. He was devastated by the experience and the aftermath of it, but he kind of just kept moving on with life. He was leading a successful life that felt unfulfilling. And then he embraced the strength and hope that's found by embracing what he discovered in that was the call on his life, right? And we've talked about it in this series, on this show, a lot. Sometimes, many times, from our crucibles come our visions, come our life of significance. And that was true for Dennis Gillen, but it took him a long time to get there. There was afraid to trip moments in the midst of that experience where he knew he had things he could say to people about the unbelievable trauma he went through in losing two brothers to suicide, but he just couldn't bring himself to do it. Warwick, what are your thoughts about Dennis? And again, Cheryl, if you have thoughts to add, please, you're quite incisive on these things.
Yeah, so Dennis is an interesting situation. On the surface, for so many years, he was, I think from his perspective, high functioning. He had a good job, was married, despite the pain and loss. Things seemed to be okay, but yet beneath the surface, things were not fine. I mean, to have two siblings commit suicide, the first, his brother Matthew, died by suicide when Dennis was in college. I think he was 20 years old. 11 years later, his younger brother Mark died. And I'm not sure if this is completely the case, but I have this sense that, well, obviously both hit him hard, but I think with his younger brother, there was a sense of, I should have seen the signs. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you're 20, I guess you can beat yourself up. But as when you're a bit older than that, I should have seen this. I, you know, so there was not just a sense of loss. I don't know if there was a sense of guilt, the sense of, you know, what could we have done to save him? But it was tough. It was very difficult for him to talk about this. It was difficult for him to feel like, well, what do I have to offer? I think somebody asked him to speak. I think at an event for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Right.
But he felt like, well, what do I have to say? Well, what do I know? I mean, I don't know that I have anything to, you know, to share, but I don't know. Maybe they kind of wouldn't let him say no, but he said, against my will, I became a keynote speaker on a difficult topic.
Right.
I think maybe for him in a, you know, much bigger way maybe than for me, because my story is not at this level of trauma, at least from my perspective. But once he spoke, I'm sure people said, you know, Dennis, that was helpful. Thank you. And so bit by bit, baby baby step, it's like, okay, maybe I don't have a PhD. Maybe I'm just a regular guy, but maybe there's something that I can do. And he had this mindset shift. And I know, Gary, this really struck you, this whole purple file deal where, you know, amidst his marriage, you know, dissolving and life wasn't easy, but he would write down positive things that people shared. And so in those days when life wasn't too good, or he didn't feel too good about life, somehow that purple file has been a key part of it moving forward. So Gary, I'd love to hear your thoughts, because I know that has really impacted you, the whole concept of a purple file.
Yeah, he, and it has. And here indeed is my purple file, which is purple. but this is what he said. He had an article in Entrepreneur Magazine, which is how we found him to be on the show. And he says, the purple file is where I keep feedback from my talk, his talks that he gives about suicide prevention. I speak to many, hoping to reach one. And judging by this feedback, some folks were listening. They often reach out to me via social media, sometimes years after they hear me talk. And I'm always touched. I print their messages out and stuff them in this file. And I did that after we talked to him, Warwick. And there are things in this file that I just held up. There's a graduation card in here from my grandmother. In case you can't tell, I graduated from high school a little bit ago, folks. But there are things in here, and the idea is what Dennis says and how it's worked for me is that, and I think it can work for everybody that's listening, especially in this profile, when you feel like maybe you're not enough. When you have a vision, but you're not sure you can walk it out. When you need that something to counterbalance that voice in your head that's telling you, now why that's silly. These are the things that you can pull out and read. And I'm just going to pull one out and read to you. And I'll preface it by saying just this little thing. I did some pro bono public relations work for a couple whose eldest son murdered their two youngest children while they were in bed. And it was a terrible story, and the press were not kind to these folks. They were very avaricious in how they wanted to get the story, and they went to the church I used to go to in Colorado Springs. So the pastor there hooked me up with them, and I represented them pro bono. And this is a note I got from the mother of those two slain children. She and her husband sent me letters, but this is from Melissa, the mom. Gary, thank you from the depths of our hearts for your strong support in us. Your guidance and counsel has literally saved us from much more pain and confusion in a world where we felt lost and blind. You became our eyes and voice in the media and public. You've become our friend. Thank you for always listening, always praying, always encouraging us into Christ. Folks, if you're watching or listening, a letter like this, I have bad days. They may not be crucible days, but I have bad days when things don't go well. That kind of reinforcement, that kind of exhortation, that kind of expression of appreciation, you know, it's like in the Fast and Furious movies when they kick in the nitrous oxide and they shoot fast. That's the kind of stuff, that's the kind of effect this can have on you. So I encourage you, especially folks who are in this profile of being afraid to trip, start keeping a purple file. Look through the things that you have in your emails, letters. Warwick, you're in here. There's all kinds of folks throughout a 40-year career in writing and communications. I've got comments in here from people, and that and it buoys me on days when I don't feel like being buoyed, which is exactly what we've been talking about here, to help people get beyond being afraid to trip.
You know, Gary, I think this is so important, certainly for all of us, certainly for people in Afraid to Trip profile, is keeping a record of those who've offered encouraging comments, because most, if not all of us, have that. But here's the thing, I think for most of us, we remember the negative and bad things people say, we forget the positive things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it's very hard for our psyches to process praise. And let's assume that in deep down we know, you know what, that praise is not perfunctory, it's not off base, it's kind of true. It's very difficult to remember praise that you know is true. Mm-hmm. Because our frail psyches, we're all frail to a degree. So I know I find that. So having it in a file, it's hard to refute and ignore when it's on paper. It's in the file. It has been said. They said something nice about me, but I can't remember what they said because I couldn't really handle it. Well, it's there. So especially for afraid to trippers, if you will, there'll be days when you think the sky's falling. Look at those positive affirmations. Okay, this is why I'm doing, you know, moving ahead with the vision. This is why it matters.
The power of, you know, Dennis Gillen's story and the power of social proof, right? People saying, wait, no, you've got to do this. You know, he sounds almost like he was dragged kicking and screaming into,
right, into this.
Right. But against my will, I became a keynote speaker on a difficult topic, but he's turned his crucible into something really powerful. And one of the things that strikes me about his story is he had a vision. He knew what he should be doing, but he wasn't doing it, right? Until opportunity that he probably didn't feel like an opportunity, where an obligation he couldn't say no to turned into positively impacting people and needing to do more. I think that that's so powerful. You know, your vision will rise up and it will get you going at some point. And that social proof can be really evidence that you mm-hmm. should keep going. And I think it's interesting for Carrie Schwier, in some regard, her, you know, she was told no. Oh, it looks good, but no. And that actually kind of propelled her to keep going after she got over that rejection. And she was like, and I think if I recall correctly, a friend was like, no, what you've got here is good.
Yeah.
Go.
Yep, exactly.
And so she still had needed that person who came alongside her and said, don't let one rejection mean no. And Warwick, even when you talked about your book, you know, the publishers that you went to, and even though, because it wasn't the tell-all they wanted, they would say decline, but they would also give you positive social proof that said, no, no, you've got something here. It might not be for us right now, but you've got something really interesting here. And I think where we can use those, take those cues and use them as lily pads to leap forward and say, okay, I must be moving in the right direction, and to keep moving forward. I think that is a powerful way to get that journey moving forward toward a life of fulfillment and significance and triumph.
206 episodes of this show. That's the first time the word lily pads has been spoken here, Cheryl. So bravo.
It's well said.
It is. Well, it's perfectly well said.
Have to include that in the Beyond the Crucible lexicon, from one lily pad to another.
That is strong stuff. Warwick, we've covered a lot of ground here. And as always, I want to give you the opportunity to share some final thoughts with the folks who are watching and listening.
Yeah, you know, it's not easy being in the situation of afraid to trip. You have a strong vision, but there's this caution, there's fear. It could be some contrails from, I think of the plane image, you know, the plane's gone by, but there's still some contrails behind it. There could be some strings from your crucible. There could be understandable fear of the future. It could be the sense of, gosh, everything could go wrong. Everybody's going to say I'm an idiot. I don't want more pain. I just want to stay in my little hole, my little burrow. it may be cold and dank, but it's at least it's the borough I've known. I just don't want to go out into the light and try something else. I just want to stay there. I know how that feels. I get it. But you've got to get to a point where the passion for your vision outweighs the caution and fear. That's the pivot point. That's where the scales turn. And for me anyway, and I think for many of the folks that we've spoken about on this podcast and elsewhere, it's the sense that, as we believe, a strong vision is one that does lead to a life of significance, that does lead to a life on purpose dedicated to serving others. So when you feel like this vision isn't about me, it's not just about parent money, it's about serving other people, somehow making the world a better place, that's when it's like, well, you know what? This vision is too important to fail. I have to at least try. And so that can be the tipping point which motivates you to take the first baby step. Even though you're going to be fearful and scared, I just remember, you know, back when that talk in church all those years ago, I didn't really want to do that. I remember when I felt like, okay, I've got the names of some publishers in Australia. I'm going to have to call them to just, you know, get their thoughts. One of the hardest things I've ever had to do is call those publishers on the phone. I hate doing stuff like that. I mean, it took a huge amount of willpower, huge amount of strength. Obviously, I wasn't going to call two a day. Try like one a week. I don't know, at least one every couple of days. But it's like, why did I do something that I hated doing? You know, caution and fear. Because if I want to help people, one part of that is getting this book published. So I did it. Even after the first phone call was like, no, at least it was no. But hey, you've got a good story here that made the second call easier. But so all that's to say is, you know, the power of one small step and just realizing the world, other people, they deserve your vision to come into the light. Mm-hmm. Use that as a motivating force. It's okay to be fearful and cautious. Nothing wrong with that. But don't let that rule. You know, make that first step because it's not about you. It's about helping others. Mm-hmm. That was helpful for me and it was helpful for so many people on this podcast.
I have been in the communications business long enough, folks, to know when the final words have been spoken on a subject, and Warwick Fairfax just spoke it. So if you want to join us on this journey, head over to beyondthecrucible.com and take the free self-assessment. You'll get your results pretty quickly, and you can discover where you are on the map now and how you can get from where you're at now to your unique life of significance. So head to beyondthecrucible.com, take the assessment, and be sure to join us again next week as we continue to explore the map we're all on as we move from trials to triumphs.
If you enjoyed this episode, learned something from it, we invite you to engage more deeply with those of us at Beyond the Crucible. Visit our website, beyondthecrucible.com, to explore a plethora of offerings to help you transform what's been broken into breakthrough. A great place to start, our free online assessment, which will help you pinpoint where you are on your journey beyond your crucible and to chart a course forward. See you next week.